Celtics lose their worst loss of the year, and it happens at a, well, unsightly time for that sort of thing. I'm Christian Arcand. This is 98.5 The Sports Hub, and let's welcome in our guest joining us live in studio for the first time here, right before we demolish this place. That's Jared Weiss of The Athletic. Hello, Jared. How are you, sir?
I'm good. I brought my sledgehammer.
Very nice. You know what? I joke about this, but wouldn't it be great if on our last day they let us just destroy this place? Wouldn't that be awesome? We get to take down all these fake windows and all the bricks and all that and just go totally hammer time on it. Wouldn't that be fun?
It would be awesome.
I think that'd
especially
be great.
Since I think they're moving in, the competitor. I think they're moving into this space.
Well, so we, you know, set the table
for
them.
We should leave them a gift.
Leave them a little gift. Jared, good to have you here. Obviously, I wish it was under better circumstances and we weren't talking about a total ass-whipping, which we saw last night. Let's start at the beginning. The narrative now is that LeBron James and these Cavaliers have woken up and that this is the real team. These are the real Cavaliers. This is who the Celtics are going to have to deal with going forward. Do you agree with that?
I think it's a pretty legitimate analysis. I mean, teams get better when they go home. It's not surprising, especially at this point of the season where the crowds are so insane.
Right.
There's so much pressure. Cleveland had 3 days to do their postmortem for what the heck went wrong in Boston, reanalyze how they want to attack the pick and roll defense, which I think was really good overall from Boston those first couple games, and figure out where is LeBron really going to be effective. Obviously, he's pretty good, so he'll be effective everywhere. But
right.
They figured out ways to get him pretty open three-point shots and to get him into weird spaces in the mid-range where the defense kind of had to converge on him, and that's when he just cut them to pieces. So Cleveland did a great job adjusting for Game 3, but regardless of all that, they were able, I think Kyle Korver put it, they needed room to be aggressive. It wasn't just about being aggressive for the purpose of being aggressive. It was they needed to give themselves opportunities with the way that they run their sets on offense or the way they set themselves up on defense where being aggressive is actually effective. And they finally figured that out.
Okay, and that's a good explanation for how they were able to succeed offensively. What was Cleveland doing on defense that was different than the first two games?
Well, LeBron was blocking everything that he
right.
could get his hands on.
Well, blocking them, and he's also taking guys down by the wrist, but okay.
That was actually kind of a weird one there.
And the Ojeleye one?
It takes a lot to take down Semi Ojeleye. He weighs like 4 LeBrons, basically.
But he did it. He got him somehow.
Well, Cleveland, I think they were more sound in transition defense, where the Celtics were really hurting them on the run in Game 2. Mm. Jaylen Brown had a few there in Game 2 where he was just blowing by J.R. Smith. There was nobody underneath the cover for that. And in Game 3, they just were really locked in, and they were coordinating, and they were communicating better. And defense, I mean, 90% of defense is just communication and being able to just know what the other person is doing. And you saw the Celtics had some very clear miscommunication issues, while mm-hmm. Cleveland was kind of on a string in lockstep throughout the entire game. So even if your personnel sucks, or even, which Cleveland has a lot of issues with their defensive personnel sucking, but they were talking things out, and they knew what they wanted to execute, and it was pretty predictable what Boston was doing at a certain point, to the point that they were forcing mid-range jumpers, isolation, breaking down those Celtics plays, and that's where they really won the game.
Do you think the Celtics were impatient offensively early on? Because it seemed like they were.
I think so, and I think that happens usually that first road game in a series for a team. You do seem to be kind of impatient. You get frustrated. You're not used to, you know, people make fun of, or I guess people laud the Celtics as some sort of like the fans are some sort of remarkable, unprecedented level of intensity. I would say that the Celtics fans are right up there as the most intense fans in the game. But there are other stadiums that are really hard to play in. And I remember last year how difficult the queue was initially for the Celtics, where the fans there were going nuts. They had, I think, Machine Gun Kelly there, gave the worst halftime show I've ever seen in my life, but that got them excited. And so that's the point, is that you have those fans behind you, and that gives you that little extra bump of energy there. And you could see Cleveland was feeding off of it while Boston didn't have it carrying them.
Yeah, it was certainly that kind of effort. And really, when you get into a hole like that, when you start missing easy shots, when you start settling for jumpers with a hand in your face, and you start really kind of giving the game away, you know, we've seen these Celtics come back from deficits. We've seen them come back from 26 points down against Houston and some other teams. You know, we were talking about it a minute ago. You did not see that run. You didn't see them ever really get together and start clicking on offense in a way that ever made you think this game could be an actual game. In the third quarter, in the fourth quarter, it never got there. And that, to me, I think, was the thing that was missing the most, is that spark, that energy, that thing that the Celtics have had all year. It just wasn't there.
And I think there were two big reasons for that. The first was the Celtics couldn't find that lineup later in the quarters that worked for them. They experimented where they brought in Yabu, then they brought in Monroe, and then they eventually brought in Ojale, but they just couldn't figure out what was that right combination.
Why was Yabusele in the game in the first quarter? Why did that happen?
Because Stevens wanted us to have fun with the memes, I guess. I have no
guess. Idea. Like, what possible what good could he have done in that situation? There's 3 minutes left in the first quarter, and I have been going on and on about how if the coaches switched, then Cleveland will be up 2-9. And then I see Stevens check Gershon Yabusele into a first quarter of an Eastern Conference Finals game, and now I'm starting to question everything here.
I'll say that I think maybe a couple years from now, that won't be a terrible substitution.
Really?
But
today, it's pretty bad.
Right now, it just isn't working because Yabu is he's still pretty raw. He has the physical capability to at some point be really effective as a switching center. But we saw in this game, he couldn't even get over the pick sometimes. He was getting lost out there. He just wasn't ready. I mean, I applaud Stevens for having whether you call it bravery or audacity, but the willingness to go to it. And I mean, come on, things were not going well. He had to try something, and he clearly thought that was something that could work, and it didn't work. And Brad said after the game, basically hinted that we're going to have to kind of rejuggle up this rotation here to figure out what's going to work. You know, sometimes in the playoffs, you take gambles and you hope that someone's going to pan out. And it's been going really well for the most part for Stevens so far. This one didn't work out. I mean, don't forget, they're really, really thin now. Larkin is someone they would go to for energy late in the quarters. He's clearly not healthy. Even at practice earlier today, he was showing that he's pretty far from being ready. But the other point to this general question of why did they never come back was Ty Lue said after the game, they're making it a point that the Celtics will get beat up in a quarter and then they'll go on a quick little like 9-2 run to end it and kind of get back in. And he implored the team, do not let them get that little run. That little run seems insignificant at first, but it's just enough to allow you to make that big run later in the game. And they actually were successful preventing that.
And Jared Weiss is here from The Athletic. We'll get to your phone calls at 617-779-0985 if you got questions for Jared or just want to continue to discuss what the hell exactly happened last night in Game 3 in Cleveland. We're doing all that right here on 98.5 The Sports Hub. Here is an update from Matt McCarthy, and we're right back after this. You will get no argument from me, Marcus Morris. Morris, bad on offense and on defense. I mean, he had 4 turnovers, didn't shoot well, didn't D up LeBron at all like he did in the first 2 games. Jared Weiss is here from The Athletic. And Jared, what struck me about last night's game and the difference between last night's game and Game 2 wasn't a huge difference with LeBron, I didn't think. I thought LeBron was excellent in Game 2 and had better numbers than he did last night. Now, last night, obviously, the rest of the team got more involved and other guys were hitting shots and so forth. But as far as LeBron James's performance, Game 1 notwithstanding, because he obviously no one showed up in that game, is there a way, in your mind or in the Celtics' mind, I guess, that they can sort of limit him to the extent that you can ever limit LeBron James and also sort of limit him from getting other players involved?
Well, the funny thing is I thought they did actually a pretty decent job guarding him in Game 2. He was hitting fadeaways over Marcus Smart from three-point range. I mean, all sorts of insane shots. In Game 3, you know, a lot of the stuff that Marcus Morris was talking about was that, like, they would go into a screen and Marcus would try to sink into the screen. LeBron would see that and immediately pop back for a wide-open shot. Or he would see Morris trying to go over the screen, cross him over, wide open three, stuff like that. He just, I think,
He crossed a bad on that 1-3.
That was really bad. And he did it again, was able to drive and make the pass. So I think LeBron has just gotten a good feel for what Morris's tendencies were in the first couple games. And they did a good job of setting up the screen so that LeBron could really take advantage of him. So, I mean, Morris, I guess, just has to be more locked in and maybe just be a little bit more conservative in how he's trying to go over these screens and stuff like that. The downside is that gives LeBron a little bit more advantage trying to get by him, but that's why they switch. So the Celtics probably just have to be more aggressive with their switching, which is something that was really effective in Game 1, something I asked LeBron about after Game 1, and he got pretty pissed off about that. So,
oh, that was you?
Yeah, that was me.
Okay. So, that was a good question, actually. That was a good question.
I think he misinterpreted the question, but whatever. The point is that Boston really executed being what they call switching up, which is something that Stevens has been doing since back when he was at Butler. They were really good with that. It allowed Terry Rozier to be effective, Tatum to be effective, all those guys to be effective. The Celtics seemed like they were sitting more on their heels against LeBron whenever there was pick and roll, and LeBron was either stepping back to take the three or he was able to attack it. So I think just being more up in his face, higher up over the three-point line, that's where you find success against them.
Were those first 2 games feel-out games for Cleveland?
Apparently,
can you say that now, looking back? Like, was that what they were doing?
I mean, they probably didn't have their strategy as figured out mm-hmm. because they didn't know exactly how they could attack Boston at the level that they did in game three. You know, feel out game doesn't mean LeBron is sitting back and going, I'm not going to worry about winning this one. I just want to read the defense. Like, they went down right. into a hole. They know that if they blow the game four here, the Celtics have a massive advantage to close out the series. So I think that they had a feel for it after game one. They tried to figure out how to attack it in game two, and that worked pretty well, but just that literally everybody else on the team was missing shots besides LeBron and Love, and Love has been pretty solid in the series. And then game three was they wanted to get George Hill and J.R. Smith going early. That worked to perfection, and that gave LeBron more freedom because the Celtics were more concerned about, can we bail out on these guys who are shooting really well? Korver, obviously, is the other one.
Yeah. Here's what kills me about that, though, is, yes, early in the game, Hill and Smith and, you know, some of these other guys, I know I don't think Korver missed a shot the whole game, but early on, you know, you saw Hill and Smith getting involved and getting some points, but they didn't have great games. George Hill was 13 points on 4 of 11 shooting. JR, 11 points on 3 of 8 shooting. None of those numbers are particularly impressive. And, you know, Jordan Clarkson, 3 of 11 in 18 minutes. You know, you didn't really see any of these guys come out and just start bombing from outside or really being consistent. And that, to me, sort of implies that, yeah, those guys didn't show up at all in games 1 and 2. You didn't see hide nor hair of those two guys. They didn't do anything. They had no points. They turned the ball over a ton. I mean, they were zeros out there. If they can be that, which last night I didn't even think was all that impressive, but it was certainly enough to bury the Celtics.
It was good enough. And that's when LeBron is clicking and Love is playing well, they just need everyone else to be good enough. And they just simply weren't in those first two games. I thought Korver has been solid the entire series. And
when he
has
plays,
been,
yeah.
And, you know, it's kind of like with some of the Celtics role players. The numbers may not look amazing with him, but you watch the film and you see how much of a headache he is for them to guard. And they like the Cavs, especially in the third quarter, when the Celtics could become vulnerable defensively because of the lineups they have out there, they like to go to stuff with Kyle Korver and Kevin Love working off of each other. And the Celtics have not been able to defend it at all so far. And that's one of the ways, going back to what we were talking about earlier, that's one of the ways that Cleveland was able to prevent Boston from going on those runs late in those quarters and finding ways to chip back into the game.
All right, let's go to the phones here before we go to break. Kelly is in Amherst with a thought on LeBron next season. What's up, Kelly?
Hey, what's up, guys? I love the show here.
Thanks.
Sorry to derail where we're at right now and look into the future here. But I have a kind of random thought. I think LeBron's going to go next year. I want to hear you guys tell me why I'm wrong and then where you think he's going to go. I haven't heard anybody say this. I think he should go to Milwaukee. I think him and Antetokounmpo, if he can bring in one more stud, that would be a nasty team. Him and the Greek Freak would be kind of like him and Wade when Wade was back in his prime. Two guys that can do anything offensively. You never know who to focus on. I don't know what you guys think about that.
All right, thanks for the call, Kelly. Let's talk about LeBron a little bit. Not so much if he's going to Milwaukee. I don't think that's probably going to happen. But in terms of his future here, a lot of people think that LeBron's going to leave town at some point, either this year or next year. And some people are saying that if the Celtics go on to win this series, that's going to kick him right out the door right away. I'm not really on that side of things. I think that the Celtics aren't the wall that LeBron keeps running into. It's Golden State. And if that Cavaliers team goes to the finals, I don't necessarily see them having a big shot against these Warriors. Celtics, same kind of deal here. Is LeBron going to stay in Cleveland? Is he going to take off? And what about this series or perhaps the NBA finals could influence that decision?
I think winning those could influence that decision, and that might be just about it, frankly. I
mean, if he wins, he'll stay, wouldn't you think?
I would assume so, okay. but not necessarily. Mm. I mean, there's been a part of that narrative that people speculated that he brought the title to Cleveland, he's taking care of Cleveland, now it's time for him to go get what he wants. To answer the caller's question, I do like that idea from a basketball perspective. But
from an NBA 2K perspective, maybe.
Unfortunately, the salary cap would not permit that because the Bucks will have right now $105 million in payroll, which
that
is over
high,
the salary
really?
Cap.
Wow.
The salary cap is probably going to be around 102, I think, next year. So they're going to be just over the cap. And the guys that they would need to trade to clear cap probably aren't really – they're going to have many takers, and they don't have the draft picks to offer to really pull that off. So I don't think that's very likely, but I do like the idea.
And just LeBron, Giannis, and Thon Maker, and everybody else can just sort of fill in around there.
Kind of
right?
all you need, right?
It would be pretty interesting.
But so, I mean, the options that are out there, the mainstream options are Philadelphia, which is fascinating, especially mm-hmm. after what we just saw. The Lakers, who seem to be very poised to clear out the space to bring in him and maybe Paul George or whomever else. Houston is the dark horse candidate. It would take some incredible cap gymnastics for them to be able to pull it off, but they could technically pull it off. And if I'm LeBron, from a basketball perspective, if I can get to Houston and keep Harden and Paul there and maybe even Clint Capella, seems like a no-brainer. They have a great program. They have a great coach. It's a cool city. It's warm, which I don't know how much he cares about. He's going to be in Mykonos or St. Thomas every other weekend anyway. But he would have a team that I think is sustainable to win for the rest of his career if he went there. The Lakers, it's really hard to envision the way the Lakers could build a team that is that much better than what Cleveland has right now. The upside to it is he gets to be in L.A., which is where he has a home, and it's L.A., obviously. He gets to finally have time to shoot Space Jam 2, which I'm sure he's been waiting for a while. And then with Philadelphia, they have the most incredible talent that he could possibly go with that's like clearly available. Him and Joel Embiid would be incredible together, and Ben Simmons. You know, obviously, there's a lot of concern because LeBron and Simmons, their template of their game is similar, except that Simmons is obviously is not even remotely close to being a perimeter threat, while LeBron, even though he's not by the numbers, a great three-point shooter, we just saw him last night destroy the Celtics with a three-point shooting. So, I mean, those are all really good options, but there's no clearly best option at this point. And I'm trying to remember off the top of my head how apparent Miami was as a possibility 8 years ago when he went there.
I remember it being around with like the Bulls and the Knicks, and like there was other teams that Miami I thought was just sort of in the mix with. I never thought they were, except Stephen A. Smith. He was the only one. Stephen A. said, yeah, he's going to Miami. You guys all watch. And then he was right.
It's amazing.
That's what I remember.
It's amazing how many wrong things Stephen A. can say, but then when it comes to new stuff like this, he's right. It's incredible. But
it's like a broken clock, you know?
Yeah. But the point is that Houston has that same feeling to me, where they seem like it's unlikely they could pull that off, but they have one of the best and most creative executives in the game. They have someone in Ryan Anderson who, if they can find a taker for him, he can empty out that salary slot for the most part that you can slide LeBron into. So I really like the chances that Houston could pull that off, and if they can, I think LeBron should be going
there. All right, Jared Weiss from The Athletic is in studio here with us. He's going to leave in just a minute, but before he does, we're going to have NBA quick hitters with Jared Weiss when we come back right after this. All right, we're back here, 98.5 The Sports Hub. I'm Christian Arcan alongside Matt McCarthy, Jared Weiss from The Athletic in the house as well. And Jared, before we let you go, we're going to get some questions to you right now. These are courtesy of our man Tom Carroll back there behind the glass. It is time for some NBA quick hitters, TC.
What's up, guys?
What's up?
We're going to do some big picture Celtics stuff here first. And the first question is, if you can have one guy moving forward, who do you choose? Brad Stevens, Kyrie Irving, or Danny Ainge?
Moving forward from right now.
I would probably go with Brad.
You'd keep
honestly,
Brad.
Cause,
over Kyrie.
Yeah. I mean, I would say that Brad has clearly proven to be their biggest strength so far, which doesn't mean that the players haven't been incredible. It's just that he's proven to be a massive strength. And you know, Danny has put together a team at this point that if they just keep this thing together, they're going to be incredible into the future. And Kyrie is, it's not like he's replaceable necessarily, but they've been able to get by without Terry. So in this wild hypothetical that I assume will not actually come to fruition in real life, I guess I would have to hypothetically pick Stevens.
Unless the NBA becomes like the Hunger Games or something. McCarthy, you want to weigh in on this one?
It's got to be Kyrie.
It's got to be Kyrie for you.
It's the NBA. It's a players league. I know Stevens is great. Give me the player anytime over the coach.
I would look at it this way. I'd look at it as value over replacement player, replacement coach, or replacement GM. You're right about Danny Ainge. Ainge has done his job. You can move on with a new GM and just hope he doesn't screw everything up. Kyrie Irving, tough to replace him, but possible, I think. I'm not sure how easy it would be to replace what Brad Stevens has given you here without his superstars. That, to me, is very unique. I'd say it's close for me. I might have to go with Brad Stevens here, too. And not because I think that, you know, Kyrie's some easily replaceable guy, but I think it might be easier to replace him than to replace Brad. All right, question number two, TC.
Assuming everyone is healthy, what is your starting five for the Celtics to start next season?
To start next season. Jared, what do you got?
Go with the starting five they had entering this season.
Okay.
So that was Kyrie, Jalen, Jason, Gordon, and Horford. So that is just about the perfect modern NBA lineup right there. And I think the very, very early returns from the preseason showed that it had the potential to be absolutely world-beating. And considering how good Tatum and Brown have grown, how good they've become over the course of the season, I think that's probably going to be just about the best lineup in the NBA next year. And, I mean, you know, as good as Rozier has been, I think all those guys are better, but Rozier is very, very close. So assuming they can keep Smart, they have an incredible little rotation right there. especially because Morris is supposed to be back next year. But it does show that they have an issue down the road of how what do they do with Terry Rozier, because Terry Rozier wants to be a starter. More importantly, wants to finish out the game and be the guy on the floor finishing out the game, and I'm sure Marcus Smart does as well. So how do you reconcile that with the fact that that starting lineup they had coming into the season, which would finish off most of the games, is pretty much a perfect lineup?
Is there enough interior play on that starting lineup you just gave? Because, I don't know, interior defense, Hayward at the four, I don't know.
They could be exposed, certainly, by teams that are powerful underneath, but they've, I mean, Horford has shown his versatility is never ending. I mean, he guards everybody on the floor, and he's been really good at it so far. And having, you know, being necessarily powerful underneath the rim defensively isn't quite as, you know, necessary as it was, or maybe having depth in that, having two guys out there isn't as necessary as it used to be. And frankly, Gordon Hayward played a lot of four in Utah next to Rudy Gobert. He has a lot of experience there, and that was one of the reasons why they were going with that lineup to start the season.
All right, number three.
How many pieces on this Celtics roster are untouchable, and if there are any, who are they?
Ooh, that's a good one. Jared, you want to take this one?
That's not really a thing. I don't think that's one.
Untouchable is not a thing.
I don't think it's in the dictionary of age, as we've seen so far, but Tatum is obviously, I think, the one that's closest to it. He's proven to be as pretty much a perfect prospect at this point. There's some things he needs to work on in this game, as Kobe Bryant recently detailed. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, those are things that I think he is prepared and willing to grow on very, very quickly and very effectively. So he's as good as they have for talent.
McCarthy, untouchables?
Kyrie. I'm not trading Kyrie at this point. And I mean, unless you're getting LeBron or Steph Curry, which you're not. So I'm not trading Kyrie.
Anthony Davis.
I would not trade him for Anthony Davis.
Okay.
Straight up. And then Tatum, I guess. But if you're getting Anthony Davis or Karl Anthony Towns in return, which I don't think you are, okay, well, then maybe. But yeah, Kyrie and I guess Tatum by default.
Yeah, it's Kyrie and Tatum for me, too. I think that if a trade like that were to come across Danny's desk and they ask for one of those two players and the return was that big, he would consider it. But Danny Ainge only does trades where he absolutely destroys the other team. And I don't know. I think that would be a tough one to reconcile there. Question number four.
Who would you rather have for the next 4 years, Marcus Smart or Terry Rozier?
I've been struggling with this all year long. McCarthy, I know I've talked to this about this with you. What do you think?
I'm a Terry Rozier fan more so than I am with Marcus Smart. However, I will say this. I think Smart is more important to the Celtics moving forward because you have Kyrie Irving here, and Terry Rozier is going to get paid starter money to be a point guard elsewhere. I think Rozier is the better player, but Smart fits better for what they're doing, so I guess I'll take Smart in this scenario.
Jared?
You know, I was asked this question a few months ago when I said Rozier at the time.
This has been going on all season, this question, hasn't it?
I think that the way things have played out so far, Rozier has proven to be that guy because of his overall versatility, because he can be traded. If he continues to grow like this, he could be traded for a potential all-star caliber player or some other massive asset down the road. So that right there, I would say that's where Rozier takes the advantage there. But Marcus Smart, in a more limited capacity, might be more important to this team because he can defend at such an elite level, provides that both the spark and the versatility that the defense needs. So it's a really tough call. I'll go with Rozier because of his all-around game.
Yeah, I'm sort of with you. I love both players. I don't think I love either one more than the other enough to sort of sway me in just what they are as players. But in terms of what they are in trade value, Rozier's higher than Smart right now. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's any question about that. So going forward for the next 4 years, I think I'd rather have Rozier the player. But if you can get something in a trade for him, I'm fine keeping Smart too. So that's my answer there. Question number five.
At the end of LeBron's career, you know, a decade from now, or however much longer he plays, how many more rings will he have?
Not one, not two, not three, not four, not any, maybe. I mean, the Warriors aren't going anywhere, right? I'm going to say one. I think he wins one more championship and that's it.
I'm going to say two, although I think his career will probably outlive me. But I think he's going to go to one of those teams where he can actually he can build a new foundation and become an elite team. So I'm going to say two because whomever he doesn't go to between Philly and Houston, assuming he goes to one of those, that team's going to compete for a while. I think the Celtics are clearly going to be ready to compete for the title next year if they don't already this year. Obviously, they're in the conference finals. So, and then the Warriors should be able to hang around for another 3 to 5 years if all goes well for them. So
Durant stays, yes.
There's just so much competition. I think the league is hitting this amazing new point where there's going to be at least four elite title contending teams.
McCarthy?
Yeah, I'll take one just based on the competition. You know, you could split it between one or two.
Yeah.
I don't think he gets to six, though. I don't think he gets to six total to match Jordan. I'm not seeing that happening for him, just based on the competition in the league.
If he does get to six somehow at this point in his career, greatest ever, I think, right? I
mean, probably.
You'd probably have to admit it at that point. All right, finally, number six.
All right, Arkand, you mentioned the Warriors. How many more titles will this core for Golden State win?
These Golden State Warriors, assuming they stay together for, let's say, the next 5 years, that might be a little much. Let's say they stay together for the next 3 years. I think they win two more rings, at least, if not all three. Jared?
I'm going to include this year and say three.
Okay.
Yeah, I guess I'll say two, including this year. But again, the competition, these last two ones are hard because the rest of the league is getting better around the Warriors and getting better around LeBron. So I'm going to be a little bit more conservative in my projections. I'll take two.
Yeah. See, with me, like, when we grew up, there was never a team that assembled itself to beat Jordan, right? Mm-hmm. Like, there was that Jordan would go to the finals, and he'd win in the finals, and then he went and played baseball, and then he retired, and then he went to the Wizards. But, like, there was never a team that was built that could handle Jordan and those Bulls. There's a team that's been built that can handle LeBron. I mean, that's the way it is. We've seen it now a couple years. And I know LeBron beat them the one time, but I don't know. I mean, I think this is so unusual and such a random thing in the NBA. Like, it has a lot to do with free agency and what that's like now and how, you know, guys can sort of chart their own course, which you couldn't do in the 80s and not so much in the 90s either. But, yeah, we're to a point now where now they have to build something to beat Golden State, and I don't know how you do that. Right? I mean, do you put LeBron on Houston? Is that the only way? Like, there's not a lot of options here.
I think that's the team that could probably do it. I mean, Houston could beat Golden State right now, even before that happens. But
That would make us all look stupid if that was the case.
That's probably true.
Right? Jared Weiss, great meeting you, buddy. Great to have you in here. I'm a big fan of yours. Thanks for coming through, and we'll talk to you again soon.
It's been real, man. Thanks for having me.
That's Jared Weiss from The Athletic. What is your Jared Weiss MBA? Is that your Twitter handle?
That's me.
Jared Weiss MBA. Go give him a follow. You probably already do. You got more followers than I do. And we'll continue on here. Matt McCarthy has your headlines, and then we're right back for our final hour.